This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. Today's episode is about grief, sadness, loneliness.
Yeah.
And it got me to thinking, you know, when I was a kid, young before I was aware of a lot of things going on, my great grandmother passed away. And we went to the funeral for just a little bit. Our parents just, you know, we didn't really understand what was going on. My older sister, though, she was a couple years older than me, she was just distraught. And I remember feeling to myself, wow, like great grandma passed away, but you know, I didn't really have a lot of emotions about it. It was just like, oh, she's gone. Whereas my sister, a couple of years older, she was just distraught with grief and sadness, even though they weren't exactly, you know, they weren't old enough to be close together. So it got me thinking, right, what was this evolutionary psychology reason behind so much grief, loss, and sadness, and what age has to do with it, and then all these other things. So I'd like to talk about that on the show today. In addition to that, you know, going through some of the articles online and going through some psychology classes in college, mm-hmm. I've heard about the stages of grief, and they are mm-hmm. denial, bargaining, depression, anger, acceptance. And this seems to be the commonly accepted reaction to grief and loss. And mm-hmm. I also started thinking, you know, maybe with all the stuff we've talked about on this show, where things aren't at first as simple and subtle as they appear with some of these explanations, I thought, well, you know what, we can cover this and see what we can learn about grief and sadness and loss.
Sure. Yeah. So, all right, you want me to just tee off?
Let's go for it.
Sure. Okay. Well, first of all, the stages that people are referring to, the supposed five stages of grief, this was the brainchild of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who was I'm not sure what she was. I think she was some kind of mental health professional, and she was one of those gutsy people that was willing to work with dying patients. And, you know, bless anybody who has that in them to do. And Kubler-Ross, you know, had that in herself to do that. And she then wrote about this. This was way ancient stuff. I think this book was written in the 60s or 70s, 50 years ago or so. And I think it was called On Death and Dying. I'm not sure. I'm not remembering everything exactly. But so she proposed these five stages of grief. And boy, she got a lot of grief for it. She became an international star behind this in psychotherapy and pop psychology circles, but she opened herself up to plenty of criticism from the academics. And the academics ultimately destroyed her theory. And then later on she said, well, you know, that's not really what I meant. So it turns out that
all,
you know,
too
the five stages.
Phrase.
Yeah, that's right. So there are not five stages of grief. That is not true. There are quite a few processes, of which the processes or reactions that Kubler-Ross described are fairly common in people that are having grief reactions. And so people will go through. Sometimes people will sort of do some bargaining in their head. Sometimes they will, you know, be angry, you know, not always, not any of this is, or depressed. Like, a lot of times nobody experiences much of any of these experiences that she talks about. Sometimes somebody will experience two or three of them, etc. They will come in no particular order. So this is not a stage process. This is an unpredictable process by which individuals will grieve different losses very differently, even in their own lifetime. The same individual staring at two different losses will have very different reactions. And so what grief really is simply the processing of a loss is what this is. But it's the reaction to a loss. Processing is starting to get fancy and talking like a psychologist. But what's really happening is, if you think about it, you are constantly experiencing gains and losses throughout your day. And so if you think also about, for example, a sports team playing, I don't know, a preseason basketball game in the NBA, well, there's little losses and gains that are taking place all through that game. And each of them, you will watch, if you watch inside the fans or the individuals, you are having emotional reactions of either positive or negative. And the negative reaction is what you could call grief, okay? Now, we might say, well, no, I mean a big loss. Well, grief is just the word that we use to describe a big loss. And so you're like, people say, well, no, I really saved that for death. Oh, really? Well, what if you're Pete Carroll and you make a haywire call of the last play of the Super Bowl last year and your team loses? Do you experience grief? I think you do, okay? In other words, any reasonable person would say, wow, that whole locker room is really bummed. They're really upset. They're like, they can't believe they lost. It's like, oh, God, their fortunes there. Sometimes, major millions of dollars to those individuals and tremendous prestige twisted on a single moment in that game. And so, and what it means for their futures and whether or not they were a Super Bowl champion, blah, blah. So you better believe that they have very negative reactions to that, some of them more negative than others. And so depending upon what it meant to the individual and essentially how closely it was tied in with their survival reproductive success. So I remember Richard Sherman, who had already won a Super Bowl title the previous year with Seattle. He was bummed, but he was like, hey, that's football. And that's because he already had a big world championship ring on his finger and a big fat contract. Whereas somebody else that had never won a Super Bowl that was on that team and was thinking they were within literally 10 seconds of winning one, their reaction could have been much greater. And so, again, seems like a strange thing to be talking about, football, juxtaposed to grief. But what I'm pointing out here is that there is not a special set of independent emotions that we're going to call grief. What there is that there's a host of different reactions that are going on associated with losses. And some of those losses are small, some of those losses are great. And then there's a process by which the human being will analyze those losses. So let's talk about grief as it usually happens and why the person will go through this process. Whenever you lose something big, you need to know it. There needs to be, whenever you lost something that is important for your survival or reproductive success, you had better have a reaction to tell you that you lost it, and it better be negative. And the reason is if it's not, then that would lead you to be careless with that asset. So you can imagine, for example, a woman with, it's a 30-year-old woman with a pair of 7-year-old twins. And she goes down bathing in the Ganges, and one of them gets eaten by an anaconda right in front of her, okay? So now do we think that she should have a negative reaction? Yes, she should have a horrifically negative reaction. She should be traumatized for life for having that happen. She put a tremendous amount of biological energy into that 7-year-old kid, and she lost it out of carelessness, perhaps, because she did not analyze the magnitude of the threat, that not being able to see through the muddy river If she ran across benefit on taking a bath in that river next time, she'd realize it isn't worth it. I could have lost my life or the loss of my other son. So I'm never going to do that again. Okay? So the grief reaction tells you that was a tremendous mistake. Now, in the case of your situation where your sister is looking at grandmother dying, there's, you know, we could speculate as to why she was marking this as a very substantial loss, okay? Now, I'm not sure, but I would be willing to bet that she was actually tracking the responses of some other people in your house. Okay, mm-hmm. So what we do when we're kids, we are attempting to learn what is really valuable and what is important. And we do this by watching the expressions of emotion from other people. Expressions of emotion are actually the observable manifestation of cost-benefit analysis that is taking place inside those brains. So whenever you see somebody experiencing a feeling, they always are experiencing that feeling for a reason. And the reason is that there is either a substantive cost or substantive benefit to their genetic success that is transpiring. So if they're biting into an ice cream cone and they're smiling, it's because their brains are cataloging that there's a lot of energy, i.e. calories, in that food, and that appears to the Stone Age brain to be of high biological value. And that's why they're experiencing a pleasurable response. And so you can watch their faces and you can infer how good that food tastes by watching the emotional reaction of the people eating it. Now,
it's kind of similar to when people are trying to eat a healthy diet, and I watch their faces when they eat totally bland food and the disgust that they show.
Oh God, that's beautiful. That's just hitting a little too close to home. So so anyway, that is correct, and so in the same way that we are built to have resonant experiences of people that we are watching. So a little kid can be cheering wildly at a game that he doesn't really understand very well, but his parents and his big brother are cheering, and for some reason they're cheering really, really loud because their team just got a big hit, and it looks like, you know, in the next few seconds the guy's going to round the bases and they're going to win the World Series. Now, this kid's only like 4 or 5 years old, so he doesn't know about the World Series. He doesn't know how often it happens. He doesn't understand the significance of this. What he does understand the significance of is the emotional reactions of his dad and his brother. That he does know, okay? So he's designed by nature to have his nervous system have responses that essentially resonate or track that, because this is part and parcel of learning how valuable things are when you don't know for sure. This is what I'm going to call computer checking. It could also be called an empathic, you know, resonance. But what the mind is doing is it's checking other minds in its environment, and it's finding out what's going on. So so for example, you can see in experiments in emergencies that were done in the 1960s by Stanley Schachter, actually Darley and Latané. They did some very interesting experiments where they would have two people in a room, and they would have a guy walk by the room with a ladder and then start working in the other room, and then have the ladder fall and essentially have a guy sound like he's in some pain. And in the original living room, or the room where the two guys are waiting, one of them is a Confederate. And so one of them is just going to sit right there and read his newspaper or his magazine and not move a muscle. And the question is, what will the other person do? And if we are not moving a muscle and reading the newspaper, then it's something like 90% of the time the other individual will not move. They'll stay right there on the couch, and they will just sit in that waiting room because they're supposedly waiting for some appointment. Whereas if they're in there by themselves, they will actually rush into the other room and ask the guy if he needs help. Okay? So this is an example, and there's different interpretations of this, but there's plenty of evidence to suggest that we look to other people for cues to find out how good or bad things are. So in this case, your sister was having a pretty acute grief reaction because she knew, obviously, she intuited what death is and that it's this bad thing and that it's a one-way ticket and you can't retract it, so we can't fix it. And so grandma's going to be gone. Now, she doesn't know how bad that is for her survival and reproductive success, but it's not good. And she can tell because she can look at her environment of people close to her, and she can see that they're actually pretty upset, and maybe one of the people is very upset. Might have been your mother or maybe her grandmother, okay? So as a result, she's on alert that this is really a bad thing. And the emotional reaction she's having is because she's computing that this must be very expensive for her because it's expensive for somebody very close to her. So that's what grief reactions are, is they are just like any other feeling. They are derived from cost-benefit analysis about gene survival. And so that is their root, and that root can take some strange places. For example, about 20 years ago, my father was suddenly in deep trouble behind cardiovascular disease. And he got an operation, and he almost died. And so he was very, very close to death for several days. And I was having huge grief reactions. And the reason was, is he was pretty young. He was in his mid to late 60s. And I was pretty sure that it was a mistake to have the operation, but he did it anyway. And so I was doing Monday morning quarterbacking on all the decisions. And so I had a lot of psychological turbulence thinking about what a horrible decision this was, you know, how it is that, you know, we made this mistake and what a tremendous loss it was. And the loss to me was that he was still quite young. He was too much of that body and mind were way too fit to be dying behind something as simple as cardiovascular disease, something very, very fixable with diet and lifestyle changes. So fortunately, he survived, and he would live another 15 years, and then he got sloppy again with his diet, and then he died at 82. Now, when he died at 82, interestingly enough, I had no grief reaction at all. So I loved the old guy, but the last half a year of his life was not worth living, and when he finally passed away, it was basically a relief. And I was mildly sad that he was gone, and I still think about him often, but I did not have what you would call a grief reaction. That's because this was already very well processed. I had already analyzed the whole loss well in advance. It didn't happen suddenly, and so therefore there was no shock to my system that there was some big loss that I hadn't seen coming. So a big component of grief reactions is how much has the loss already been analyzed, and a big reason why losses need to be analyzed is they need to be essentially prevented if possible. And so if you've experienced a big loss and that loss was surprising, then it's very likely that the grief reaction is going to be quite acute. Because your nervous system is going to be basically trying to get your attention and say that we need to analyze the daylights out of why we had this loss, because we never want to have a similar loss in the future. So we clearly may have failed to take essentially protective measures against this mistake. We need to be very, very, you know, sort of guilty and miserable, et cetera, about the fact that this happened so that we are sensitized to these conditions and we don't make the same mistake again. So these are, in other words, what I'm trying to explain to people in a way that we do not, let me explain briefly, Nathan, how psychologists typically will see this. They will see feelings as sort of part of your life, and you have to have them. And then they have a really ridiculous idea that if you, quote, block your feelings, this is not good for you physically. Like, this is how psychologists think. They are very uneducated.
That's how psychiatry came about, too, right?
Yeah. So this is all really haywire thinking about how psychologists go about their analysis of why people feel and why they do the things they do. This is all incorrect. There's not a single scrap of evidence. There's a tiniest scrap of evidence that is all essentially meaningless in this whole pile of craziness about, quote, how you have to feel your feelings, and if you block them, this is bad for you, et cetera, et cetera. No, this is not what's going on. Feelings are signals of genetic survival and loss. So every feeling that you have is a little circuit that is going off in response to data that is telling you that you've either had a slight win or a slight loss, or a big win or a big loss. And so if you have a big loss and it was a surprise in any measure, or if it did not seem like it should have happened, then what your nervous system does is it analyzes the magnitude of the loss, and it will then run an assessment about how much mental energy it is worth searching for the cues and the clues that would have made this preventable. Okay? And so it may search a long time. Like, for example, I had a woman client that was in her must have been 80 years old, and she had been grieving the loss of a child that she had lost in an auto accident at about 50 years earlier. And she apparently she'd been to a bunch of therapy and nothing had fixed this, and this was really a very unpleasant process for her in her life. She was routinely grieving this. And this didn't make any sense to me, other than the fact the brain was still questioning the decision-making that she had done, and she was still Monday morning quarterbacking this, and I couldn't understand why. Now, I'm not going to give you the details, because the details, if this person still could be alive and they could hear this, and I'm not going to, I want to protect their identity. But the point is that there were some social circumstances in this accident that when other people came to analyze it, they essentially pointed the finger at her. And it turned out that this is not the case. There were other people that had made mistakes in the situation that had led to this accident, and all it needed to be was to be analyzed from an objective perspective. And pretty soon it became obvious from the recounting that she had done everything humanly possible to stop this from happening. Now, once I had taken her through, and what I did is I went back through the entire accident, I'm fascinated that nobody had done this before, by the way. And so I took her back through this in a method similar to what Edna Foa uses with rape victims. And Edna Foa is a famous University of Pennsylvania professor that revolutionized the treatment of PTSD. And so what I did is I went through this, what we would call frame by frame. And every little decision, everything that she could remember, we fed this all into our analysis of what transpired. And by the time we got done, it was obvious to her, as it was to me, that she had made, excellent moves, and really you couldn't have improved her performance. When that happened, what was remarkable was that her grief essentially disappeared by the end of the session. So this was 75 minutes, and we were done. And I checked in with her a week or two later, and it turned out she remained done. In other words, the haunting of her nervous system that had been going on for five decades, quote, a grief reaction that wouldn't leave and that nothing could help, turned out what it needed was it needed exactly what we do need when grief will go on indefinitely, When grief is going on indefinitely, folks, it's because there is a part of the mind is puzzled, and it's like a jigsaw puzzle that you haven't solved, and there is some part to this that you haven't quite grasped or grokked it, and the mind knows that it's close, and it keeps searching, and it keeps searching, and it keeps searching. It's like Einstein looking for the unified field theory. It haunts them all. It can haunt them all the way to their grave. Okay. Whereas if you can solve it, if you can get somebody to help you solve it, if you can actually see through what the nervous system is worried about and where it feels like it's not sure that it got it figured out right, if you can get it analyzed properly, then you can close the loop and end the grief. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So that is another function of grief. I'll give you another quick example very interesting. Sure. I'll give you one more question. I had a woman that I may have told this story before, but I had in a different context. But I had a woman that got married early in life, and by her late 20s, 7 or 8 years later, her husband and they got a divorce, and they had been like high school sweethearts. So they'd been together kind of their whole lives, and then they got a divorce. And then I came upon the scene about 15 years later. I think it was about 12 years later. And the husband had gotten remarried and had a couple of kids and lived on the other side of the country. And this gal could not stop thinking about him, and she dreamed about him constantly. And the problem is, this is what an open loop is. So she was, quote, grieving the loss of this relationship. And I said, no, what's happening is you are not sure that you didn't make a mistake, okay? So you are haunted by the idea that you made a mistake. You know, it's been another 12 years. You haven't found anybody as good. And your nervous system is cycling and cycling over this. And the only way to fix it is for us to go across the country, meet him, sit down at lunch, and process it. That's how you're going to do it. Okay? So she did. She packed up her car, drove 3,000 miles, and met this guy for lunch. And by the end of lunch, she was done. Okay? In other words, very quickly. In other words, they were very friendly. The wife knew that this was going to happen. You know, she wasn't hitting on him. She just wanted to, like, connect. And I said, this is what this is going to be. You're going to have this experience. That shut that loop off forever. Okay? And that loop had been open for, like I said, about 12 years. So this makes sense that if we cannot understand something and it seems like it's very important, that it will haunt us until we get the insight. And the mind will continue to spend energy on it to the extent that it feels like it can solve it. And then very often, just to close this thought out, that the mind will in most cases, it will start to fade down on how much energy it expends on a grief process, because it will find out that it can't solve it, it can't do anything about it. It will run the cost benefit on those energy expenditures, and it will eventually fade this down to very quiet, but not in all cases. Oh, so one last thing, and then you can ask your question. My point here is to explain that grief reactions are no different in principle than any other reaction of any animal, and that is that they have an evolutionary root, they have an evolutionary purpose, and their purpose is to aid and abet gene survival. The purpose is not to, quote, protect the ego. The purpose is not to, quote, feel the pain, honor the dead, or anything else under the sun. Okay? Any other explanations are incorrect to varying degrees. The reason for grief reactions is because grief reactions evolved as a signaling device to aid and abet decision-making that would statistically increase the likelihood of survival and reproductive success for humans. That's why human beings have these reactions. So these reactions are principled, they have a purpose, and when they extend and are particularly painful, it is because the loss generally was either particularly unpredictable, possibly preventable, in other words, unpredicted, unseen, not anticipated, and the loss to the individual was very significant. And those are prime examples of factors that will lead a grief reaction to be extended and relatively severe.
Now, my question is, how about grief reactions with things that I guess science doesn't know yet, for example, or at least people believe they don't know about, for example, cancer or old age? Old age is kind of, it is what it is, but my mind is processing this and thinking, okay, well, if I had somebody who was just somebody, you know, I was deeply close with, and they were, say, you know, 40, 50 years older than me, and they passed away, how could I have prevented that? I mean, there wasn't really, you know, they passed away of old age, or if they passed away from some cancer that can't be modified with diet and lifestyle changes.
Right. Sure. And so you're going to have grief reactions to people that are valuable that you lose. And those grief reactions are an inevitable part of the fact that you valued them highly. So you can't value someone highly and not care about whether or not you lost them. Okay, so that's sort of the issue. Now, I think that what's happening with some of the consternation of grief reactions around, say, the extended horror of someone dying of cancer, is that you're seeing that the person is alive and that they are in a bad process, and it feels very strongly like that process could be preventable. In other words, it could be stoppable. And so as a result, you are feeling the urgency and the panic that is like, oh my God, it's slipping away. You know what I'm saying? And every indication that the person is losing the battle is essentially reminding you the time is running short and that you must find the solution. And if you don't find the solution, you're going to lose this individual, and this individual is very valuable to you. And so this is the swirl of grief and, you know, the horrendous process that we go through when someone very close to us is very ill, is that the fact that this is not like this is a very different kind of a deal, whereas if, you know, our brother goes out, you know, to war and then he dies and he comes back and we're like, oh my God, like what happened and how did this happen and oh my God, I can't believe it's my brother, and et cetera, et cetera. So we're having this huge grief reaction after the fact as we try to figure out, you know, how this could have been prevented. Whereas when we're watching someone who is alive and they're slipping away, that's a different process. There is an urgency and a sort of a panic and a helplessness that are all going in, swirling around, essentially taking up workspace in the brain as you run the numbers on what could I possibly do? Is there anything that we could possibly do to fix this? And once again, the more valuable the individual is, the greater the grief reaction is going to be. Okay? So if it's your uncle who you kind of liked, but he was kind of a jerk, it's like, oh, well, it's kind of too bad for Uncle Bill. You know what I mean? And you feel a little bit bad for him, you know, but you don't feel that bad. Whereas if it's a beloved father, you would feel tremendously bad. Okay? It's like, oh my God, this is one of the four most valuable people in my world, for God's sakes. Or three, or two, or it might be the most valuable person in your world. At which point the loss is tremendous, and the mind says, keep searching. Keep making sure you're not missing anything. You know what I'm saying? Keep looking, keep looking. We've got to find a way out of this problem. And that's how these processes are all a little bit different, because they're all a little bit different angles on evolutionary problems. One of them is it's too late and it's over and there's nothing to be done because the person's gone. You know, what could we have done differently? How did this happen? You know, et cetera. What on earth can I learn from this? Because I never want to experience a loss like this again. And so that's one way that grief works. But the other way that it works is it works right there in real time as we're staring at the individual as they're slipping away. So they are two somewhat different processes, all but the processes all have the common thread of essentially gene survival is being lost, and we don't like it.
And is there anything that somebody can do if they're presented with a problem that they really can't figure out?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think there, you know, each individual is different. So there's different individuals have sort of a different amount of this is where the big five comes into this.
Mm-hmm.
So if you happen to be an individual who's very emotionally unstable, and you are very open to experience, and then you are going to be looking for every bizarre, crazy cure in the world, and you're going to be all excited when you think you find something, because you know somebody says if you give coffee enemas, you know what I mean, it's going to get rid of their cancer, and so you're going to want to get your dad to try that, you know what I'm saying, and
mm-hmm.
you're going to be all excited about it, and. Your etc. But if you are not so open to experience, or you are not so emotionally unstable, then you are not going to be so turbulent in the experience. So this is I can't remember, in the 1980s there was a woman at the University of Michigan, and I've forgotten her name. She was for a long time probably the academia's most respected voice in grief. And which I can't remember. I haven't, it's been a long time since I took a final, so I can't remember her name. But I should. It'll come to me in the middle of the night tonight. But Camille Wortman. That's who it is. So anyway,
I was googling it to try to sound smart.
Okay.
You beat me to it. You're faster than Google.
good for you. Okay, I'm almost positive I got that right. So anyway. So what she had done was done something that nobody had done. This is post Kubler-Ross, and Wortman actually went and gathered data on people that had gone through grief reactions, and she watched them, and she took psychological data on them, had them fill out forms, and did interviews and so forth, and she did this for an extended period of time after losses. And what she found was interesting, and she didn't have the kind of theory that I've just given you, that this is all part of the web of evolutionary design. But what she did find was the following. She found that she actually thought in terms of sort of personalities rather than in terms of a combination of personality and situation, which was probably a weakness of her analysis. I'd have to go back and read her papers and see how much she equivocated on these issues. But as I recall, she essentially said that there's sort of four different types of people and how they go through grief, and I'm sure that's a mistake. But she said there's people that have very mild grief reactions, and that in 2 weeks they are pretty much as good as they ever were. And she then noticed that there was people that were horrendously depressed, you know, for 2 years, and they would very, very slowly come out of a grief reaction. And then there was a couple in between. So she described these four different, instead of five stages of grief, Wortman had four categories of grief. And unlike Kubler-Ross, she actually had data. So this was very, you know, legitimate science that was done, and it was very interesting, and there was some clinical utility out of this, because one of the things that she discovered was that in the people that 2 weeks later, she actually found that people were having, in other words, just as this was a very important insight and discovery, actually. And that is that people were very often having just as many positive mood states as they were normally, but they were also having waves of negative mood states. And one of the problems is is that they could be like their beloved mother might have died 6 days ago, and then they go out with their friends for a friend's birthday party, and they're like laughing and joking and having a good time. And somebody might say, God, you seem fine. I thought you were all bent out, upset about your mother dying. And here's the deal. They were upset about their mother dying. But they are actually not, they aren't uniformly constantly upset about their mother dying. They can be moved into different social situations, different situations, with having different neural circuits fire and be quite unconscious of that at that period of time that their mother died. In other words, it's still there. It's in their mind, but it's extremely quiet. And they can be having a very positive experience. And then if you point it out, interestingly enough, they can feel guilty because it's as if they don't care about their mother, which is not true. And so the very interesting thing about Wortman's work is that I was able to use this clinically with people in my career where they were having this happen to them. Like, I'm laughing, you know, with my friends, but my loved one just died very recently in the last few days or the last couple of weeks. And I would say, this is actually very common. This is a common thing that your emotional life is quite compartmentalized. So notice you can be really upset with, you know, some clerk at Macy's, and then you can walk out and then there's a message on your phone from some girl, Nathan, yeah, I'm just giving you a hard time, that you wanted to hear from. And suddenly, boom, you switch and you see you have this flirtatious text from this great girl, and you're like, suddenly you're happy. You know what I'm saying? So we just shift the situation, and suddenly your emotional state, you've still got lingering irritation with the clerk, but it's dialed down by 90% now that we're looking at our cell phone, looking at the text message. So this is explaining that human emotional life can go through very, very rapid shifts, as we can see in any football game. That we can, oh, we're all high because we just scored a touchdown. Oh, God, you know, they just scored a touchdown on us. Oh, we're going really well and we're almost going to score. We're all happy. Oh, we fumbled. Now we're miserable. So you're seeing these dramatic shifts of emotion depending upon circumstances. Human beings do the same thing during the life processes when they are experiencing or have experienced a major loss. And so we will not see them put on a black veil and be miserable for X period of time. Okay, that is not how human beings work. Human beings are their emotional life is shifting constantly, and if they've had a major loss, they will ruminate on that loss to varying degrees, depending upon, you know, how big the loss was and how expected or unexpected it was.
Yeah, my dad has a interesting idea as to what he wants to do at his own funeral, and. My dad's hilarious. My mom and him would always just jokingly argue at the dinner table. And he said, I don't want anybody crying at my funeral. I will have lived a good life. So he's joked several times about having a hidden video in their home where he sits there and says all kinds of things that he's always wanted to say, makes all kinds of dirty jokes that he never could do, and says all kinds of self-deprecating humor. And his will say that you have to play this at my funeral. He wants everybody to be happy.
Oh, what a character. I've never heard of anything quite like that, Nate, and I think that is brilliant and just fascinating. Fantastic. What a character.
Yeah.
Wow, what a great idea. I think I'm going to copy that, cuz God knows people are going to be miserable at my funeral. Goodness, that's great.
I'll be there for sure. For sure, I promise.
And you'll bring a date. Oh my God. Bring one for me too. I don't want her name to be Mabel or Evelyn, you know. No, Mildred. Yeah. Oh my goodness. All right. Yeah. Is that good, or do we
that,
have more
that,
we
that,
want
that,
to look?
That's
look
great.
At?
No, I think that's great. Yeah. Any kind of final thoughts as to what people can do for their own grief? It sounds like what you're saying is, if people are dealing with an extreme amount of grief, is to cycle through and to see what, from an objective standpoint, what could have been done to prevent this, so that they know for next time.
Right.
And if they can't cycle through this, to go on your website and talk to you, esteemdynamics.org.
Sure. Write to me. You could just describe to what has got you caught in a loop. And I may be able to point you a direction, or at least give you, it may be worth finding a therapist, hopefully a competent one. Cognitive behavioral is the direction that I typically like to go, and in other words, get some help, because you are not designed to. These reactions were designed to get your attention and to be part of a normal loss process. They were not designed to have you cycle for years on these things. And if you're cycling for a very, very long time, then absolutely get some assistance and see if we can think our way out of it, because we probably can.
Mm-hmm. And any words that you have for friends who have experienced extreme loss and grief, how to console them, how to support them best?
I'm trying to think about that. I think all you're really, you mean like if a friend of yours just experienced, maybe they lost their mother or something. There's nothing special that we do. We follow our instincts and do a pretty good job of this. This is just all about letting them know these are times when people signal to each other, how important are we to each other, and sort of what does the coalition matrix look like? And so if our friend loses their mother, and we know that they are in pretty tough shape, then all we need to do is to communicate with them that we're really sorry for their loss, and is there things that we can do? You know what I'm saying? And the better the friend it is, the more energy you spend actually doing things, rather than saying, when it's like your 14th best friend, what you say is, gee, let me know if there's anything I can do. When it's your fourth best friend, you should say, hey, I'm going to take care of this and I'm going to take care of that. Okay. So you signal by your actions how valuable they are to you, and that's how they will. This will help their emotional life stabilize and realize that they're valuable. That you're sending them an esteem signal, and your actions will speak very loudly there.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.